So I will start with an apology. I will not be able to be as accurate and precise as my experimental colleagues, and not as deep and profound as Jesse, but I'll try to cover this subject. So I don't know if I gauged my lectures accurately. I was having in mind mostly the experimental students that might not have seen what I'm going to say in details, probably for the more formal theoretical students, what I'm going to say, at least today, will be maybe elementary. So throughout my lectures, I'm not going to use SI net units. I'm going to use what are called natural units, which means h bar equal to c equal to 1. As the lecture will evolve, I might evolve into supernatural units, where pi is equal to 2 is equal to 1. But okay, I'll try not to give at the end also the accurate formula. So let's start with dark matter. So it's an experimental empirical fact that the energy budget of our universe today, besides the observed baryonic component, has at least, roughly 25% component from what is called dark matter, which is an unknown matter which behaves non-relativistically today. So this is parametrized through parameter omega dark matter, which is just defined as the ratio of the energy density in the universe of dark matter over the total observed one. And this is roughly a quarter. All right, so in explicitly raw dark matter is order 0.5, 10 to the minus 5 GeV per cubic centimeter, or 2.5 milli electron volt to the 4. So this dark matter is the average density, this number. However, at large scales, dark matter is homogeneous, but at shorter scales, has large inhomogeneities, and those are observed in experimentally in the clusters of galaxies and the galaxy themselves. So you can imagine that the actual picture of the universe has overdensities of dark matter, which are distributed some way, and they clap. And basically where the overdensity are, it's where you have most also baryonic densities, like galaxies. So we happen to live in one of these overdensity, where the galaxies are. And there, the energy density in dark matter, locally, is actually much larger than the figure I show there. It's roughly what was also mentioned the morning, of order 0.4 GeV per cubic centimeter, which is roughly 10 to the 5 bigger than the average dark matter in the universe. So we happen to live in a very special location of the universe where the local energy density in dark matter is 10 to the 5 bigger, which means that this location is 10 to the minus 5, is 10 to the 5 more rare in the universe than the average number. Of course, we are not surprised by this fact, since as we expect that dynamically, the galaxies, the baryonic matter, will fall in gravitation into this overdensity, so it's not a big surprise that locally we observe an overdensity as we happen to live there. So what else we know about dark matter? Well, one thing we know dark matter, since it's non-relativistic and since it's basically a clump around the gravitational bound objects, the velocity of dark matter is non-relativistic. It's actually of order 10 to the minus 3. And this comes from the study of, for example, the distribution of virial velocity of the stars in the galaxies and from the study of the gravitational potential by equipartition, by virialization of this gravitational bound object. And this is pretty much what we know about dark matter. We don't know what it's made of. And in particular, if we described it as an elementary particle, we don't know the mass of this elementary particle. We have only a very, very, very rough bound. We know that it must be larger, the mass must be larger than 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. But it can basically be all the way to M Planck, which is over the 10 to the 27 electron volts. And this is if it is compounded by an elementary particle. If it's a composite particle, a composite object, in principle can be M masses which are even much larger than that. So where this bound come from? This bound come from the fact that if the mass of dark matter would have been lighter than 10 to the minus 22 electron volts, its de Broglie wavelength would have been larger than around 10 to the 4 light years. And this means that, and this is roughly the size of the smallest gravitationally bound over densities of dark matter that we observed so far, dwarf galaxies. So if the masses of dark matter cannot be lighter than that, otherwise it would be hard to explain objects as small as this. Let me put an intermediate scale, 10 to the 2 eV, where something happened. And that something was already anticipated in some of the lectures this morning. Has to do with the properties of how dark matter behaves if the energy density is what I wrote there. So for light to dark matter, you can compute what the occupation number is. This is just the energy density of dark matter over the mass of a dark matter particle. So this is the number of dark matter particle per unit volume. So if you multiply by the de Broglie volume, you get the number of particles that have exactly the same quantum numbers. So you can replace the de Broglie wavelength written in terms of 2 pi, if you want, over the momentum of dark matter, which is just the mass times the velocity. Velocity is known as roughly 10 to the minus 3. So here you get that this object scales like rho dark matter over m to the 4 pi cube over b cube. So you can replace with the rho dark matter, for example, the local dark matter density here and the velocity there, and you get that this object here is roughly of order 25 electron volts over the mass of dark matter to the fourth power. So if the dark matter mass is smaller than this number, 25 electron volts, then the occupation number, at least locally, will be larger than 1. If this happens, it means that dark matter cannot be a fermion, because by Pauli exclusion, the occupation number can be at most 1. So we know that in all this range, dark matter must be bosonic. Instead, in this other range, can be either fermionic or bosonic. In particular, in this range, the occupation number is much less than one. So this means that the dark matter particles are isolated one from the other. In this range here instead, where basically most of, well, all my lecture will focus on, the occupation number is large. It means that the various particles will overlap. And as you see, the occupation number scales with the fourth power of the dark matter particle. So the moment the dark matter particle is below electron volts or so, the occupation number becomes microscopic. So in the bulk of this region here, the occupation number can be as large as 10 to the 30, 10 to the 50, and so on. So in this range of masses, dark matter behaves as a classical field, a bosonic classical field. And indeed, it's more classical. In most of that parameter space, it's more classical than us in this room. So feel free to interrupt and ask questions at any moment.
Where did this 10 to the 2 EV bound come from?
Oh, sorry. It was supposed to be this 25 EV here. Roughly. In super neutral. Well, probably also this 25 is not that sharp. I mean, there are uncertainties a little bit everywhere. Okay? Another question?
Or something. Am I just remembering things wrong, or
you mean below or above?
For some reason, I remember that the fermion, there's a name to the bound of like the lowest mass. I forgot the name, but I thought it was like around the Tremaine bound. Thank you.
Yes, this is a very rough. In fact, if you have fermions, it must be quite above that.
It's not the same number. The Tremaine bound is around 70 EV. It looks like the Tremaine. Oh, someone's scared. The Tremaine bound is for fermions, but it comes from other structures, right? So it's more constrained, but it comes from dwarf galaxies, so it's a bit more constrained. So there's a Tremaine bound that tells you that if you have a fermion, and it, forget about self-interactions because of Pauli's exclusion, you cannot have high occupation numbers, and that number is about 70 EV. And it comes from dwarf galaxies, that's why it's slightly different than the...
Yes, I used the our galaxy.
Yeah. Okay. Can you pass it along over there? Oh, you want to talk?
Oops. Okay, so we know there is some cosmic abundance of dark matter. So where does this mostly come from? From galactic or extragalactic?
Oh, so we know that the average density must be this. So this is the average density across the whole universe, both inside and outside the galaxies.
Yes.
Instead, in the galaxies, we have over densities. So the typical value is much larger than that.
Yes, I'm asking if we know how much fraction of dark matter is inside galaxy versus outside.
If we know that?
Yes.
Yeah, we know, well, we have some information. We know from the rotation curves of the baryons how much dark matter must be at these distances. And then in between this outside, there are basically just numerical simulation that can explain what is the profile, but there are also information about relative motion between galaxies in cluster of galaxies and so on. So at different distances from the galaxy, we have some information about what is the dark matter contained in each of these shells, basically.
I mean, like, for example, is it possible that the background abundance that is outside of galaxy is actually much less than the what we measure cosmologically? So most of the dark matter is inside galaxies. I'm asking if there's observational constraint on, let's say, the ratio between the amount of dark matter inside galaxy versus outside overall.
Well, I'm not sure also what's the definition of galaxy, because these halo that are much bigger than the actual galaxies that you see. And they basically, then it depends where you put the boundary, what you call galaxies from what you call cluster of galaxies and so on.
Okay. So you're saying, yeah, this is very blurry. I mean, it's difficult to really say if the dark matter is part of a galaxy or not. You're saying it's a very smooth thing.
Yes. There are structures at each scale. So.
Okay. I guess I just, thought about it in the wrong way. Okay. Thank you.
Right. All right, so this is what we know about the masses. What about spin? Well, we know even less about the spin, except that we have some at least in the case of elementary particle, we have some constraints from theory. So in this range of masses, we said that the particle is bosonic, so the spin can be either 0 or 1 or 2 or 3 or so on. So from the discussion of this morning, learned that if we have a massive particle with spin 2 or larger or 1 and larger, it depends now what your definition of composite is. So if it's a massive spin 2 or larger particle with mass, it must be composite. For spin 1, you can call it composite if you call the W composite in terms of Higgs mechanism. And instead, if it's particle spin 0, it can be completely elementary. In fact, for the mechanism I'm going to talk next, it focuses on the spin zero. And in fact, I should say that probably among this type of dark matter candidates, the spin zero is the one that is more theoretically robust or plausible. I will comment more towards the end of the lecture on this point. So for the moment, let's focus on spin zero particles. And what we know also that matter is that it interacts gravitationally, while all other type of interactions with the standard model are at least very small, if not negligible. So as a very first approximation, let me write the most simple dark matter model that you can imagine with this ingredient, which is just a free massive scalar field with Lagrangian of this kind. So phi of x is a scalar field. And the equation of motion is just the Klein-Gordon equation. Box plus m squared phi equal to 0, where box is just d in dt squared minus d in dx squared. So these are the analog of the Maxwell equation for a field that is a scalar, so which means that at each point in space, you just assign a single real number instead of a vector like for the electric and magnetic fields. So this is the minimal prototype of dark matter model. And as you will see, this is all you need to explain dark matter. And in fact, as we will see, the production mechanism that we are going to review probably next lecture, it doesn't rely on any particular type of coupling of the particle and any type of potential for the scalar field. So all you need is just the mass and approximately almost approximately small interactions. So for this reason, this type of mechanism of production of dark matter is one of the most model independent you can think of. So before going to the details of how such dark matter particle could be produced in the early universe, I'm going to review a little bit the properties that such a particle will have today as a dark matter. And then we will go through the history of the universe to see how it can be produced. All right, so this is the equation of motion. So it's a simple Klein-Gordon equation. The generic solution is just a plane wave. So phi of x be proportional to an amplitude. And for example, cosine of some frequency, omega k times t minus three momentum k times x, plus an arbitrary phase. So this is a single plane wave with definite three momentum and energy and frequency. And the most general solution will just be a superposition of plane waves with different three momenta frequencies. The frequency is bound by the equation of motion to be a function of k and the mass, in particular omega k square must satisfy the usual relativistic constraint on shellness of the particle. And the superposition, the general solution, can therefore be written as, for example, a superposition of three momenta with basically just Fourier transform the general solution, or a sum of plane waves if you have only a discrete one, okay? All right, so now if the solution must explain dark matter, the typical velocities, as we said, must be small of order 10 to the minus 3. So this means that the three momentum k modulus is much smaller than the mass. So if dark matter virializes inside the galaxy halo, the distribution of velocity is typical Maxwell-like, which means that the dispersion of velocity is of order 1. So delta V is of order V, is of order 10 to minus 3. So locally, this means that locally in space, if you look at one particular point in the galaxy, for example, where we are, and we measure the values of the field at this point, x, as a function of time, we can Fourier transform and we get a spectrum spectrum in frequencies, which is inevitably highly peaked around a particular frequency. And this particular frequency is nothing else than the mass plus corrections are the kinetic contribution, which is 1/2 mv². And since v square is of order 10^-6, the dispersion in velocities, the actual frequency of this Fourier transform, of this spectrum of the field, is very close to the mass of the particle up to 10^-6 corrections. The width of this distribution comes only from the dispersion in velocities of the field. Yes. Oh, this is, you can imagine that by virialization, the distribution of velocities is like the Boltzmann, the Maxwell distributions. Maxwell distribution tells you that the variance in the in the distribution of velocities is basically order the average velocity time the factor, I don't remember, 1/6, 1/3. Yes. Well, this is what you expect from the virialization of particle in a gravitational potential.
Can you actually elaborate? I've always wondered, because I always thought that Maxwell distribution comes from thermodynamics, when you have a thermalized gas at a constant temperature, right? The right now around us, we're at 300 Kelvin, this is Maxwell distribution, but,
yes.
But when, because the molecules are, there's a thermal bath. Virialization is something different. There's no thermalization, yes. Like you have no interactions here whatsoever. So how is this thermalized? How can it possibly get the Maxwell distribution when there's no thermalization mechanism?
Yeah, indeed, we don't know indeed if the distribution is really Maxwell or something similar. And that's why I said Maxwell-like. But even if it doesn't thermalize by just virialization, but just by gravitational exchange of the momenta, you would expect that the distribution by just equipartition of energy distributed over basically momenta of that kind. Yes.
Can I add to that? I mean, yeah, Giovanni said it. Like, there's a famous paper by Lyndon Bell. There is a famous paper that discusses that violent relaxation when you have in the collapse of the structure. So when the dark matter is unbound from galaxies, it has a very, very small uncertainty in velocity. But the moment things become self-gravitating, the couple from the expansion of the universe, they violently collapse very quickly. And this is exactly what causes this equipartition of kinetic energy and potential energy. And this is Lyndon Bell. This is from violent relaxation, and he used it to discuss stars, actually the formation of stars. There is another fact that a thermal equilibrium will not give you this distribution. So thermal equilibrium, because dark matter is self-gravitating in the galaxy, is supporting the potential of the galaxy supported by dark matter itself. So if you have something that in thermal equilibrium has gravitation interactions, it wants to be actually very compact. It wants to have, there's something called gravothermal collapse. So it will actually, it's a very unstable situation. So the fact that, and of course, what this being said, supported by dark matter simulations, people can identify streams, but if you average over the average velocity of streams, there is very little power in each stream. So overall, it follows a quasi-Boltzmann distribution. And so we are lucky that it's not in thermal equilibrium and it's just virialized. It's a good thing. Yeah. It takes, thermalization takes a really long time. Yeah.
Good. All right. So the dispersion, because v squared is of order v squared, which is the average v squared, which is of order 10 to the minus 6, the dispersion of this peak is also suppressed by 10 to the minus 6. So the width of this distribution in frequency is very, very small. And it's basically set by the fact that you have just a classical field, which is not highly non-relativistic. And of course, these properties have very important consequences for the experimental point of view, as probably many of you already know. Just to put some numbers in. So the Compton wavelength of the dark matter particle with mass m can be of order kilometers, tens of kilometers, already for in the bulk of the values of the region I'm discussing. So for masses of order 10 to the minus 10 eV, the Compton wavelength of the particle is tens of kilometers. And the de Broglie wavelength is enhanced by 10 to the 3, by the velocity. So we are talking about megameters. For similar values of the masses. So you see that in most of the parameter range we are interested in, the de Broglie wavelength is macroscopic, and this is and the Compton wavelength as well, which is important facts if you want to realize, of course, experiments which are tabletop, because in this means that this coherence will be acting on macroscopic states. So inside your detector, you can assume that basically the field is coherent and homogeneous. The frequencies associated to those oscillation of the wave here, so this frequency is basically m plus small corrections. It's basically set by the mass. And for that reference value, we are talking about tens of kilohertz. Of course, as you change the mass, and as you change the mass by 10 order of magnitude above and below, of course, all these numbers change accordingly. The frequency can be even below Hertz or in the lowest part of the spectrum. And in that case, experiment like pulsar timing arrays can become relevant. Finally, the coherence time of this field is basically set by the width of this peak. So it's 10 to the 6 enhanced with respect to the frequency. So we're talking now of order of tens of seconds. Which are very long times that indeed you can exploit with experiments if you go on resonance. So this, I want to stress a little bit more about the origin of this coherence. So the origin of this high coherence signal associated to this dark matter is just due to two factors. One, that you have a very classical field, and two, that this field is highly non-relativistic. And you can think about these properties both from a field theoretic and a particle point of view. From the particle point of view, this coherence is not associated to any quantum coherence, but it's just, as I said, a property that comes out from high occupation number and the non-relativistic nature of dark matter. So you can think that if you are somewhere at each in some particular point, at each time you'll be traversed by many particles because the Brillouin wavelength is so long, so that the amplitude of the field that you measure will be an incoherent superposition of many waves, each one with frequency omega t and some different momentum pointing in a different direction, different phases in principle. Now, on each particular point, you'll have basically a random phase that sums up. So if you sum, and while the frequency is almost always the same, so basically set the mass plus small correction. So now if you sum plane waves with random phases, the overall magnitude of the field will just be of order the square root of the number of particles that will transverse your detector, which is the occupation number, and will oscillate with a frequency that is set by m plus small corrections of order 10 to minus 6, which are not coherent. But of course, they will lead to a decoherence only on times that are 10 to the 6 larger than the frequency. So you can really think that at each point in space, you are traversed by long wave packets. The wave packets is long because the de Broglie wavelength is 10 to the 3 oscillations in frequency. And since it's slow, it will take another 10 to the 3 more time to pass all the way through. So this means that you leave you with 10 to the 6 oscillation that you can record in phase before another wave packet to pass, and basically it completely defaces. And in fact, the same parametric you can obtain just looking at the level of fields. This will allow me to introduce so the calculation from the field theory point of view. So you can compute the energy density in this classical field by basically considering the Hamiltonian density of our theory. The Hamiltonian density is given basically by trick contribution, the derivative with respect to time square of the field, plus the gradient of phi square, plus the mass term. This is what you get, you obtain the Hamiltonian from your original Lagrange. Now you can compute the average energy density in a volume V. So this is just the integral in d3x of rho of x over a volume V, average over V. Let's say that V is at least a de Broglie wavelength, but can be larger than that. So this will just give d3x 1 over v. And then you have, so from the time derivative, here you get a factor which is omega squared sine squared kx. You get the contribution from k, from the gradient k squared sine squared kx, plus a contribution from the mass term, is cosine squared kx. Now, if you average this over at least the Brillouin wavelength, this average of sine squared or cosine squared, they all give you factors which are just v over 2, 1 alpha for each period times the number of periods in units. So you'll get from here, and using that omega squared is equal to k squared plus m squared, you'll get just 1 alpha omega squared. I forgot the amplitude of the field. Everything is multiplied by phi squared. Phi naught square. So this is the average energy density in this plane wave field that I wrote here. So the number density is just the energy density over the typical energy of each of these waves, which is omega. So you get that the number density is just the amplitude squared with the factor 1 half times omega. So the occupation number that you can get from here will be just the number density times the de Broglie wavelength, which is 2 pi over k cubed, the volume. So, and if you put everything in, you get 1 half phi naught squared omega over k cubed and some factor of pi. Okay? So you can invert this relation. Let me write it here. You can write the amplitude of your fields in terms of number of particles of the occupation number. So you get that phi naught is scales like, well, now let me forget about pi's. It will be proportional to k cubed over omega times the square root. Sorry, I have to take the root of that. Times the square root of the occupation number. So you see that already, that from also from the field point of view, you'll see that the amplitude of the field scales like the square root of the number of particles, the occupation number in the particles. But from this prefactor, you can also write as omega times the velocity to the 3 half. You see that the contribution from a single quantum is of order omega v to the 3 half. So for a relativistic like photon, for a relativistic field, you'll see that each quantum will have a magnitude of fields, which is basically set by the frequency. And when the amplitude is much larger than the frequency of the field, you get a large occupation number, a classical electromagnetic field. Now for a non-relativistic limit, you'll see that at fixed value of the field, it's much easier to get a classical field because the each quantum will contribute with a smaller value of the field. So for at fixed amplitude of the field, with a small velocity, you get a larger occupation number. And in fact, if you look at the zero mode of a massive scalar field, at infinite volume, it will always be classical. You always have infinite occupation now. Questions? Ah, here. Here. Ah, sorry. Yeah, because it comes from it's the kinetic energy, right? So it's m times b squared.
You have written the de Broglie wavelength as well as the Compton wavelength, I think, like two different wavelengths. The first one is a Compton wavelength, right?
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So, how do you? What's the difference? What's the difference in the interpretation of these two quantities?
Compton and de Broglie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, de Broglie is the inverse of the momentum. Right. And so it tells you it's basically what is associated to the uncertainty principle.
Yeah.
Instead, the Compton wavelength is just associated to the single oscillation of the field.
So how should I think about the first one, the Compton wavelength?
Sorry?
I don't really know how to think about the Compton wave, like how to interpret the lambda c.
I'm not sure. Oh, so for example, this is basically it describes basically the size of your apparatus if you want to resonate with this oscillation. So this is the scale that you have to have in mind if you want to resonate with this field.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Okay, so this is basically all I wanted to say for the properties of a dark matter field today. So let's now see how this field could have been produced in the early universe. And to do so, we have to understand what happens as we go back in time at earlier stages of the universe. Of course, you might think that the abundance of this, how do we end up with this distribution of dark matter with this field, might strongly depend on what is your initial condition for this field, especially given the fact that, as of now, I'm assuming that this field indeed is not interacting with us except then gravitationally. And this is partially true. But to see it more in details, let's see what happens in the early universe. So one thing about the universe is that it's expanding. And the expansion of the universe can be described as really an expansion of space-time, as creation of space in between every two points of the universe. So you may think that if you write a grid in your universe, and as time goes on, this grid expands. So any two couple of points that are apart at the distance delta x get expanded, and their distance is increased by factor A of t, where A is the so-called scale factor. It describes how the universe expands with time. And A dot, the derivative of A with respect to time, it's positive. That basically is a statement that the universe is expanding with time. Now, to compute how A of t is a function of t, you had to basically solve the Einstein equation, which I do for you, in three important cases. One case is when the universe is dominated by radiation, which means that most of the energy density in the universe is associated to relativistic particles. If this is the case, by solving Einstein equation, find that the scale factor of T grows with time, like proportional to the square root of time. If instead most of the energy density in the universe is dominated by non-relativistic matter, the scale factor grows, but with a different power, T to the 2/3. Finally, if the energy density of the universe is dominated by what is called the cosmological constant, I think it is like a constant in your Hamiltonian, then the scale factor grows exponentially with a constant H naught that is associated to this constant in your Hamiltonian. One important parameter associated to this expansion is actually the rate of expansion, which is just A dot over A. It's called the Abel constant. And in these three, for these three cases, the Abel constant will be just 1 over 2t in this first case. Sorry, the Abel parameter, not constant. 1 over 2t in this case, 2 over 3t in this other case, and just the constant H naught in this case. I'm not deriving all this because it will take another lecture, but this is the result of solving the Einstein equation with three different types of matter in the universe. So in all these cases, the universe is expanding. And what does it imply? Well, so if you have non-relativistic matter in a cube and the universe is expanding, the cube will become larger, but the number of particles inside the cube will stay the same. This means that your number density of non-relativistic matter, it will decrease by a factor which is one of the scale factor cube. Okay? Because the volume is growing by each direction is growing with A. So the volume will grow like A cube. So the number of particles over unit volume will decrease like 1 over A cube. However, as if you have a wave with some wavelength lambda, and you expand the box by just expanding the grid, also the wavelength will be redshifted, will expand, which means that momenta k also decrease with 1 over A, which implies that this is for matter, non-relativistic matter, that radiation have energy density that reshift like 1 over A to the 4, a factor of 1 over A cube from the number density, and an extra factor of 1 over A because the energy associated to each particle will also decrease. Instead, for matter, the energy density will just give it given by the mass of each particle which doesn't reshift, so we'll still reshift like 1 over A cube. Radiation. Of course, in the last case, if you are dominated by cosmological constant, as we are actually starting to be dominated today in the universe, this scale factor will decrease exponentially, and this basically suppresses every matter or radiation dense energy density exponentially. You can think of this decrease of momenta also as like a cooling due to the expansion of the universe. So if you now look at our field, our classical field, what's the implication of the expansion of the universe? Well, to look at this, you have to look at first the Lagrangian, which is the integral in space of the Lagrangian density, which was the object I wrote before. But now if the universe is expanding, there will be an extra a cube factor in front, because the physical distances are also increasing with the scale factor. So your full Lagrangian will be the integral in d3x, a factor of a cube, and then the Lagrangian density I wrote you before. And now if you derive the equation of motion for this field, you will find that there will be the usual, before you had the box of phi equal to zero, now because you have explicit time dependence here, you break Lorentz invariance from the expansion of the universe. So the equation of motion will not look like covariant in under Lorentz transformation, but it will look like this way. You have a phi double dot. Then you have a term that associated to the gradient, which look like this, 1 over a square of t, gradient square phi, spatial gradient. You have a term, another friction term, which is 3h phi dot, and eventually you have the m square phi equal to. So you have two important modifications with respect to flat space. One is you have this extra 1 over a square factor in the spatial gradient, which is basically telling you that the spatial momentum of the fields are decreasing with the scale factor a square. So this is just this fact, this from the particle point of view, this is just this factor here. And then you have this extra contribution here. This extra contribution is 3a dot over a, and it comes basically when you integrate by parts, the time derivative acts on a cube, it'll bring down this extra piece here. And what this piece does is basically create a friction for the time evolution of phi, which basically decreases the energy. So you have two basically loss of energy, one due to the fact the spatial gradient decreases with time, and another one from the actual friction from the Hubble expansion. So this loss in energy of the scalar field just associated to the fact that energy is not conserved because you have explicit time dependence in your Hamiltonian or Lagrangian. And basically, the expansion basically decreases the full energy of the energy density of your system. Okay, but this means that now if you look at the system back in time, if you look at our universe and you start going back in time, if all the energy densities decreases with time, it means that if you look back, they must have been larger and larger the more you go back in time. This means that the size of the field will grow, the occupation number will grow, the momenta will grow, the temperature will grow. So as you go back and back with time, the temperature of the universe will be higher and higher. And if you don't change the physics, you just assume the standard model with the observation we made, this temperature will grow indefinitely as you go back in time until it blows up. So this blows up is what is called the hot Big Bang. So let me sketch. Small picture. So let's say that this is T today. And you go back in time, let's say here. So time is flowing in this direction. let's say this is the time at formation of CMB. And then all the way to some initial time very close to, let's say, in Planck, some UV scale. Now, if you are an observer here and you look back in time, let's say that this is space, you'll start seeing that different points in space have temperature which are actually very close to each other, despite the fact that they were never in causal contact. So a place here and a place here measure temperature that are agreeing at 10 to the 5 precision, despite the fact that this is a system of very high temperature and it's never been in causal contact with each other. This is what is called the horizon problem in cosmology. And by far, the most plausible and simple explanation is that somewhere in the early universe, before the CMB, before BBN, the universe had a phase of exponential expansion, it's called inflation, which is basically just a phase where, like today, the universe was dominated by an approximately cosmological constant. In this case, the universe would have expanded exponentially and would have brought, in the very early universe, regions that appears to be not in causal contact, in causal contact, and would explain why the universe looks very precisely homogeneous, isotropic, at very large distances. Having this phase in the early universe, this inflation phase, what it does for you is that makes the universe flat and homogeneous. The way to see this is that the momentum, each gradient in field and each particle momentum P will be suppressed exponentially by this expansion. So any original inhomogeneities that you could had in the early universe before inflation, let's say, would have been killed exponentially by this phase of exponential expansion. And basically what this system does, the inflation does, is basically cools down the universe exponentially fast and make it homogeneous and flat at very large scales. So because of this, we expect that at the end of inflation, our dark matter field, phi of x, will look like basically very homogeneous, almost like a constant. Have 1 minute? No. The last plot, which I don't know where. So no matter what was the initial condition for our scalar field at early, before inflation, let's assume that it was some random distribution of the field. This is space, this is the field. When inflation starts, each small portion of space will inflate exponentially. And, oh my God. And our visible universe will only observe a very tiny portion of the original distribution of the field. So the field will look like almost constant on very large scales. The value associated to this field will be some particular value that, however, could have been different in different parts of the universe. For example, in this part also will inflate exponentially. And here, the universe will look again homogeneous, but the value of the field will be different. Today, we'll only be able to see only part of this distribution. This part of the universe is still outside our horizon. And for this reason, what we will expect from this picture is that any scalar field will be constant and homogeneous, but the value of that field cannot be predicted. It's just an environmental value that we have to measure. And this is basically set the stage for the future evolution of the field we are going to see tomorrow morning. Thanks.
Let's thank Giovanni. We have the time for a few questions. You were too clear in your lecture. Well. Yeah.
So what happens at the interface of these patches?
You mean here or here?
There, right.
On the right, here?
Yeah.
Well, you see, there is a lot of space here. Each of these points will inflate exponentially. So eventually you have a distribution that varies very, 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 exponentially small. So this part of the universe will be basically in Rome.
Sorry, right now for the phi you're talking about, is this phi, I know you're trying to make this phi dark matter later on, right? But is this, could this phi also be like the inflaton?
So this phi could be any scalar field whose mass is small compared to the Hubble parameter, so the rate of expansion, exponential expansion of the universe during inflation.
No, so yeah, right. I was just asking, could you make this phi also the same phi that drives inflation?
Well, the inflaton itself, for the inflaton is similar in the sense that you have a scalar field with some friction that is almost constant, but then eventually the inflaton is the clock of our universe. So at the end of inflation, the field will roll down and its value will be different. So you're asking if I could have a different places in the universe, the inflaton in different position would inflate with different Hubble rates and will give me in principle different patches of the universe with different properties. That is true. But here I'm assuming this picture that this field is not dominating the energy density of the universe. So it's just an observer on a background expansion. If you want to identify this field with the inflaton, then you have to take into account that there's a different point in this potential, the Hubble rate will be different, and you might not even inflate, depending on the flatness of this potential.
Thank you.
Backing up quite a bit, you showed us the distribution of the frequency of the dark matter if we have a spin zero bosonic dark matter. And I was wondering if that shape looks the same even if you have other spins.
Sorry, I missed the first part. What it looked the same there?
You showed us a picture of like basically like a very sharp Lorentzian with a width of 10 to the minus 6 because that's
the frequency spectrum of the factor. Yeah, that doesn't depend on the spin. So that is just the spectrum of a free field, which has a large occupation number, is not relativistic. So it's completely insensitive of the spin of the particle.
So in that case, were we focusing on spin zero so that you could use phi, but everything else is the same?
I'm focusing on spin zero because of the rest of the discussion I will discuss tomorrow, because I'm assuming this is an elementary field. while if it's a higher spin particle, it will be composite, and now it depends whether it will still look like elementary at the inflation scale. Typically, if you have higher spin particles, they look elementary only at energy below the mass. Above the energy, above the mass, you will start looking at the substructure of the particles.
So when you say composite, you mean they're like interacting with each other? What do you mean by composite?
What I mean by composite? Yeah. By composite, I just mean that basically the size of the particle is bigger than its Compton wavelength.
Okay, thank you.
Just, I think you were also asking about like other elementary spins, and misalignment for the vector works very differently, right? Like that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, tomorrow. But yeah, actually, I don't even know if I would call it misalignment for vectors. And
I have a question. So, you gave like a range on the Compton wavelength of the dark proposed dark matter particle. So I have like a very basic question. Are there any tight bounds? Like, where do we get these tight bounds on the dark matter particle, proposed particles? How do we get the bounds on the mass of these?
Yeah, the only bound, actual bound I showed was this 10 to the minus 22 electron volts, and come from the fact that if the mass will be smaller than that, the de Broglie wavelength will be larger than 10,000 light years, which are the smallest gravitationally bound object we saw. So if the de Broglie wavelength will be larger than that, you will not be able to explain the presence of gravitationally bound dark matter clumps that are so small, just by uncertainty principle. So a particle with such a small de Broglie wavelength cannot be contained in such a small space.
Any other question, curiosity? Okay, if not, I'd say that we can thank Giovanni again.